for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Byron Janis has been called a living legend of the classical music world. His wife, Maria Cooper Janis, is the daughter of actor Gary Cooper, as well as an artist and a parapsychology researcher. He played through the severe pain of arthritis for decades before becoming a spokesman for the Arthritis Foundation. Today, he continues to perform, teach, compose, and write for the Wall Street Journal. Together, they've written a book about an extraordinary life in music and the paranormal. The title is Chopin and Beyond. Byron Janis and Maria Cooper Janis join me throughout the hour. We'll take your calls, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Feel free to join us on Facebook and send us a tweet. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Lovely to see you. I think that the subtitle of this book, My Extraordinary Life in Music and the Paranormal, is clearly there to provoke the interest of people. Why did you decide to include that in the subtitle, Byron Janis?
Well, the life in music is obvious, but the paranormal has been a major part of my life. I started having these strange experiences when I was very young. And I started this book 10, 12 years ago, and then I said, I can't write about this yet, about the paranormal, because I thought it was, but it is a very controversial field, unfortunately. But then I decided, yes, the time felt right for me to write about this.
Maria, how did you feel about including that in the subtitle?
Well, I was all for it. It's been part of my life as well from the time I was a child, in a very different way from Byron's. But it has enriched both our lives so much that it would have been false to exclude it.
Tell me about some of the experiences that you have had that so inform your life.
Well, from my part, I had a lot of early telepathic experiences with my mother, which might be considered obvious, and a lot of people have. And then I had a girlfriend who we were very closely connected in that sense, and it was, you know, it was fun. It was just amusing and interesting, but it showed me that life, that reality was much more than our five senses could inform us of.
And you, Byron, you said it began for you quite early.
Yes. When I was very young, I said something which I couldn't understand. I said, I want more than music. And I already was playing, and I thought, this is my life. Music is my life. How can I say I want more than music? What is there except music? And then gradually I began to understand what I meant by that. It was dealing more in a larger way with human beings. It was dealing in a way beyond music, where I could be of some service.
Give me an example of some experience that you had that so informed your life that you knew it was going to be part of your life.
Well, one of them, I think, was very interesting. There was a period when we were in California staying with some friends, and I went out. It was very late, and I decided to go back to the guest house to join Maria, who was there. And I was walking out of the main house. I heard these bells ringing, but unbelievable. What can I say? There were an unbelievable number of them, and it was some sort of an extraordinary sound that they were making. And I thought, my God, bells, where is this coming from? So I ran quickly back to the house, got our host, who came out, and he said, my God, these are bells. I said, yes. I said, what is it? He said, well, there is a church about 2 miles from here, but why at 10 to 2 in the morning? What is it? Anyway, we found out the church never heard these bells. Nobody else heard these bells except Maria, our host, and I. And that is something interesting, because very often in this field, some people experience this something and others don't see it. Some do and some don't. And that's what makes the controversy, of course. But what happened was I became friendly with a great friend of Maria's, Dolores Hart, who was an actress. They were grooming her to be a Grace Kelly sort of very beautiful girl. And she suddenly joined the Benedictine monastery and at age 21, was it, Maria? I think.
Close.
Sorry. And anyway, so I called her and I said, tell me, what is this? Is there any, I had this strange experience. Bells. And she laughed. She said, what time was it, Byron? I said, it was 10 to 2 in the morning. And she then really laughed. And I said, why are you laughing? She said, 10 to 2 in the morning is the time that monasteries throughout the world do their most serious praying. And the bells would be, meaningful, because monasteries with bells and all that. So that was pretty strange,
I should say. Take us back to your early days, Byron, when you first began to play the piano.
I was given a xylophone by my uncle for Christmas. We were told to bring our favorite things to school that we were given. I took the xylophone, and the teacher was playing the piano. Children were dancing around. I was 4 years old, and I began to pick out the tune on the xylophone that she was playing on the piano. And she was startled, of course, and said, Byron, can you do that on the piano? I said, I don't know. So she lifted me up onto the piano bench, and I picked out exactly the same tune that she was playing by ear, obviously.
Interesting.
Next thing I knew, they were in my home telling my parents, this is a boy with an ear and tremendous, you ought to start him studying the piano. That's how I really started.
But early on, there was a problem with your little finger. When did that develop?
I was 11 years old, actually, and sort of arguing with my sister, and I was chasing her, and I stuck my left hand through a glass pane in what I think they're called French doors, and removed it quickly, and my finger was a mess. It was sort of hanging down and looking awful. I was rushed to the hospital. They operated. They cut the tendon. They cut the nerve. I lost the joint. And to this day, that finger is totally numb. And the doctor said to me at the time, well, you'll never play the piano again, but there'll be something for you to do, I'm sure. So I said, I didn't accept that. I just naturally went on and said, no, I'm going to play. And I found ways of dealing with it. And, to lose one, it's like playing with 9 fingers, because I didn't feel it. I still don't feel it.
You still don't feel it.
Oh, no, nothing. Zero. I don't feel this finger. So I learned ways of using my eyes differently, of using my hand differently, of dealing with it. And I never told anybody about this until about 1989 or 90, when Perret did a cover story and they spoke about arthritis. And then I told them about this finger.
And Maria, surely you knew about it when you and Byron were married.
Oh, yes, of course. But it was just something that, it was not to be discussed. And Byron, I think one of his ways of overcoming the impediment that it caused was simply, to the best of his ability, to ignore it. Because he had worked out over the years from 11, I think your whole body compensates when there's an injury. And I think that's, you know, it was just part of our life. And I mean, when I listen to him play, I totally forget he doesn't have 10 totally powerful fingers, because it's.
But he is using that finger.
Yes, he uses it, but as there's no feeling, I guess you developed a whole new way of locating yourself on the keyboard, because the sense of touch is what tells you where you are, because, you know, the fingers are going too fast for your eye to see every note, so it becomes a whole instinctive process, I believe.
And, do you think it is an instinctive process, Byron?
Well, it was for me. I mean, I simply, well, there was no question I had to continue playing. It was my life, and I just ignored it. It was mind over matter. That's when I learned mind over matter, which is a very important thing for all of us in whatever we have, because now, you know, with the arthritis, and now I'm interested in juvenile arthritis with the children, I keep telling them, you know, just, you have to forget it. The brain can't function on two things at once. Can only function on one thing. So if you put your focus on something else other than pain or other than the problem you're having, you will not be able to think of the pain. So the focus with me, of course, was music. But for other children, lots of things.
Byron Janis and Maria Cooper Janis, together they have written Chopin and Beyond, My Extraordinary Life in Music, and the Paranormal. Short break, we'll be right back. Welcome back. Here in the studio, classical musician Byron Janis with his wife Maria Cooper Janis. Together, they have collaborated on a new book. It's titled Chopin and Beyond, My Extraordinary Life in Music and the Paranormal. Byron Janis, your book begins with several extraordinary experiences regarding Chopin.
Yeah.
How did you discover the two lost versions of his waltzes twice?
That startled me the second time, I must say. I found, you know, it was, both times were totally accidental. In Paris, in a chateau, first time, and they were in a trunk marked old clothes, and we were looking through it, and I just saw these manuscripts somewhere. And when I told the Comte de la Penouse, he said to me, oh, those are just things my mother was scribbling down. My grandmother was scribbling down. I said, no, they're not. They are Chopin waltzes. And one of them has no manuscript that is known. It was published after his death. Nobody knew the manuscript. So here was a manuscript. And this whole story became very interesting, and the New York Times put it on the front page, and Walter Cronkite, it was all over the place. And I'm telling you that for a reason, because 5 years later, five, was it, or six, five, yes, at Yale University. I was giving a master class. They said, would you like to see some of our music? They have a tremendous collection. And just before leaving, I have no idea why, which is the mystery in this whole thing, I pointed to a shelf. And I said, what's that? This professor climbed his thing, and he said, oh, it's Marc Chopin. I said, oh, can I see it? I opened the folder. I'm happy I was sitting down, because there were the same two waltzes. The same two waltzes in earlier, in written a year earlier. Yes, that's one of them.
I can see your fingers moving even as you're listening
That's
to this.
That's a reflex, I guess.
Maria, what was your reaction to all this?
Well, you know, I think when something is so big, one is astounded and you sort of don't know what to do except say, oh, gosh, you know, here it is. What was an amazing moment when Byron performed the waltzes at the Chateau, there was a special evening with... which CBS filmed, actually, and then there was a fire and it got lost. but Giscard d'Estaing was there, and Sergeant Shriver, the Kennedy family, some were there. Someone said, this is the first time those waltzes were heard since Chopin wrote them.
Wow.
I mean, you know, because there it had been buried, unknown.
And that, it gave, you know...
Go ahead.
And it gave such an indication. It was so interesting to see how a composer... changes his mind from year to year, just like we performers do, if we're any good. We never play the same twice.
But are you saying that even though it was the same waltzes, there were differences?
Oh, yes, differences. And the published one was... first one was 1832, the next one was 1833, and the next one was published 1835. Very, very many differences.
The question becomes, why, after hesitating 10 years ago about including anything regarding the paranormal, why now, Byron?
Because it was something, as I was writing my memoirs, I had to include this. It's a major part of my life, and I wanted to try to tell people, hey, this is not so abnormal. You know, in the 4th century, St. Augustine said, miracles are not contrary to nature, but only contrary to what we know about nature. And that is the whole thing, what we know. We know so little. Einstein said we know 2% of how the universe functions. 2%. So 98%, we have no idea about. Can you imagine what those 98% are going to show us? All right. And people have this fear, I think, of the unknown. This is what the concept is. They're frightened of the unknown. I love the unknown. I'm frightened of the known.
And you, Maria?
I feel exactly the same way. I think the reality that the quote paranormal, which is the wrong word.
What is the right word?
Well, Byron coined the right word.
Byron. Yeah, I call it the unknown normal.
I like that much better.
All right.
And I think the word paranormal evokes in most people, because there have been so many, you know, bad, spooky, scary, you know, ghosts and spooks and oddball, off-the-wall things. You know, for us, the paranormal is a part of our everyday life. And it, for me, it makes us aware of how much we overlook, you know, little synchronicities, things, telepathic exchanges that happen between people. You know, you think of someone you haven't talked to in 10 years and suddenly the phone rings and there
exactly.
they are.
Exactly.
I mean, and I think we all tend to say, oh, well, yes, ha-ha, coincidence. But you put those together and I think they're telling us something. I think they're signposts on a road that we really have not traveled far enough along at all. And I think many people are afraid of it. And I think that's a pity because there's so much beauty there and there's so much richness in our own growth.
Well, it's the one place that can help us, the unknown, with things that we are experiencing that are great problems. And scientists, not too long ago, NASA's researchers found a bacteria in the bottom of a lake in California that lived on arsenic. That was the only thing that it lived on. And, I mean, arsenic is killing to us, but that makes you think, what is there out there with what kind of life is there out there that lives on arsenic alone? And there must be many other kinds of unknown things, the people that we say we can't live on, that are going on. So every time we make a discovery, we are making something that was thought impossible or abnormal or not normal.
Tell me about your mutual discovery of each other the first time the two of you met.
It was a magical moment. Many people say that. Actually, it was quite a series of coincidences because I'd been given a recording of this virtuoso American pianist, Byron Janis, Prokofiev III, piano concerto, and I fell in love with it, and I was doing some etchings at the time, and I started working inadvertently in time with the music so intuitively that I frayed the tendon in my right wrist, and I had to have surgery. So my mother remarried, a wonderful doctor, and they were in the south of France on Cap Ferrat staying with friends, and my mother said, you want to come over? It's July. Join us. And then the night I arrived, a party was being given for the bride and groom, my mother and her new husband, and one of the first guests to walk out on the terrace was Byron Janis. And I couldn't believe it, because here was the man whose face I'd seen on the cover of the Prokofiev III album, and in fact who had caused my wrist. And my arm was in a cast, still from the surgery. So it was kind of an amazing moment. And we were just introduced, and we looked at each other, and we both knew something about each other, that we weren't strangers. I mean, it sounds corny, but it absolutely was true.
Byron, yes. Describe that moment from your perspective.
Well, it was an incredible moment because I was about to be divorced in a very difficult situation, unpleasant, and I was rather depressed. And here was someone, I looked at Marie and I said, I've known this girl before. I've known this. I just knew it. I knew her. Strange. It wasn't a feeling of overpowering love for someone, but that came later. But I knew her. And later on, she told me she had exactly the same feeling. So that is it. It was written down in her diary, actually. So that was kind of interesting that we knew each other. And what was so important for me was, my goodness, hope returned. Hope returned to my life after, really, I was very down in the dumps.
How long have the two of you been married?
46 years.
46
years. Yeah.
Yes.
And because of your own upbringing, Maria, you had very little fear about being involved with someone as famous as Byron.
Oh, absolutely no fear. I mean, I was... It was certainly very helpful to have been raised in a family that was creative, that was intense. I had a very real awareness of what a performer needs when he needs his own space. You know, walk through the room and don't talk. Shut up. I've always been totally comfortable with the intensity that goes into being around a person who has to perform. I mean, my father was a much less volatile, quieter type than Byron, but still, in his own way, you just know there are certain parameters that you respect. And I know, you know, girlfriends of mine would say, oh, well, how can you this and how can you that? And don't you feel rejected? And I said, oh, come on. No, you know, this is exciting. It's a privilege for me to be part of a creative act. I mean, I find it very hard to go to a city just as a tourist because for all of our 46 years traveling, you go to a town and you're giving into it. You know, Byron is leaving something there, he's giving to it, and the response with the people. And it's not just a taking thing. And even though, you know, I'm not performing, but it's part of the whole thing.
Maria Cooper Janis and Byron Janis, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. How old were you when your dad, Gary Cooper, died?
I was 24.
How well did you know him?
Extremely well. Extremely well. Of course, it's always too soon, and certainly he was 61 years. He was 60 years old, and that was much too soon
much
for me because, you know, now I wish, I'm naturally shy, I guess quite like him, but, you know, now I just wish, oh, I could have talked so much more, and I could have asked him so much more than I did. But nonverbally, we had a wonderfully close communication, and he taught me so much by example, and he and my mother were a wonderful team. I was really lucky because I knew I could never play one parent off the other.
And speaking of teaching Byron Janis, how did you come to be taught by Horowitz?
My first concert with orchestra was with the NBC Symphony, Toscanini's orchestra, when I was 15. My next orchestral concert was in Pittsburgh, my home, which I left when I was 8. But I played with the orchestra. I was 16, and there was a great conductor, sorry, named Lauren Mazel, conducted the Philharmonic for a long time.
He was how old at the time?
14.
14 when he conducted.
He was 14,
that.
I was 16. And by chance, Horowitz had played a recital the night before, and he was in town, so they invited him to the concert.
This is Horowitz.
Vladimir Horowitz. And he came, and he came backstage to see me, and I was, of course, thrilled, and he made some very nice remarks to me, and he said, when you come to New York, call me. I'd like to hear you play some more. So that's how we met, and that's how our relationship musically began. I was the first student he ever had, you know.
How was that relationship? How would you describe it?
Well, he was a very interesting, in retrospect, teacher in the sense that he never overtaught. He would say, something doesn't seem right. You go home and think about it and bring it back to me next time. He did not teach, oh, you've got to do this, you've got to do that. Huh. He left it up to me, and that was difficult, but I think so important.
Unlike an earlier teacher who had you at the keyboard with water, a glass of water on your hands, and if the water spilled, what happened?
A ruler would come down on my hand and really hurt.
Wow.
He was Russian. He said, that's the way we're taught in he was Russian, in Leningrad. So I was, when I came, actually it was Joseph Levine, who was another great pianist, who heard me when I was 8. I was brought to New York to play for him, and he said, we would like to teach this boy. So I went to New York, but I hoped he wasn't from the same conservatory. And he was from Moscow. Unfortunately, they didn't use rulers in Moscow.
How outrageous. What a way to teach a child.
I agree. But he said, this is what we did in Russia.
And the hands had to be absolutely
still. Yeah, and you know, you can't be totally still when you play a scale. You can't. And I mean, but always spill, of course. But then he did teach me. I must say, I began to play fewer and fewer wrong notes, so maybe it worked.
Byron Janis with Maria Cooper Janis. The book is titled Chopin and Beyond. Short break and right back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Kauffman Foundation, working to grow economies and expand human welfare. Learn more at kauffman.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs and their innovations to solve the world's most pressing problems at skoll.org. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, the new science of dog behavior. Some trainers say, don't let your dog win at tug of war, you'll appear submissive. Not true, says John Bradshaw.
If you do let a dog win over and over again at tug of war, it likes you. It wants to play with you more than it did to begin with because it's having fun.
Bradshaw's new book is Dog Sense. Join us.
And we're back with two extraordinary people here in the studio, Byron Janis with his wife, Maria Cooper Janis. Together, they've written a new book. It's titled Chopin and Beyond, My Extraordinary Life in Music and the Paranormal. And for the first time, Byron Janis and his wife have talked about their experiences with the paranormal, something that 10 years ago he thought he'd wait, and now has talked about his own experiences and their experiences together. We have many callers. I'm going to open the phones, 800-433-8850. First to Pensacola, Florida. Good morning, Jeff. You're on the air.
Good morning. I lost my hearing about 10 years ago to a surgery, and I'm a brass player. And I just recently picked the horn back up, and I've found the difficulties of the physical disability to be something I can overcome. But it's been the mental approach to the music that I'm having more difficulty with. you know, maybe so much as, you know, as you perform, you project part of yourself through the music, and when your confidence has been destroyed and trying to rebuild it, it's very difficult. And I wanted to know if there was any sort of advice that was given to people who are maybe post-op for arthritis surgeries on the mental approach towards their music after such, you know, possibly career-ending surgeries, that they regain their music.
Well, yes, I think, look, my life and what I've been through with arthritis, my little finger and all these things, shows me that almost nothing is impossible. Now, if you have got to feel that music is the most wonderful, beautiful thing in the world, which I imagine you must feel that. And, I had 5 hand surgeries, by the way, 5 on my hands, one which shortened my thumb. And through all this, though, music was the most beautiful thing in the world to me, and it still is. And I think it's spiritually more important to people than it should be, I think, than even religion, because it goes to another part of us. Religion has caused so many wars, unfortunately, and the spiritual part of us is very important. And that's why music is so important, I think, for children, for everybody. And I just think you have to say, I love music, and mind over matter again.
It was quite amazing to see Byron in the process of the recovery from the surgeries. As soon as the doctor said he could, he still had a cast on his hands, but 3 fingers were exposed. And Byron said, well, can I work my scales with those 3 fingers? And the doctor said yes. So there he was at the piano, still with the cast on, but he was exercising with the 3 fingers that worked.
So you confident you can do anything you really want to do, believe me. It's
yes.
Just
good luck to you. Here's a tweet. Byron is said to be good friends with Uri Geller.
Right.
Do you still believe in him?
Absolutely. And for all those who don't, and there are some who don't, certainly, just look at his website, and there's a new film that the CIA has released on their early work with him at Stanford University, which is our Defense Department. And it'll show you what he could do at a young age. And the CIA, as I say, is not to be sneezed at. So,
and you, Maria?
Oh, it's there's no doubt. I mean,
what is it about him and his work and his being that creates such faith on your part?
It isn't a question of faith. I mean, is the sun going to come up tomorrow? You know, unless the world blows up, it's going to come up. It's a question of concrete knowledge. It's also something that's being researched by science. It's part of an energy system. Our human ability, our electromagnetic field, and its ability to interact with matter. And other people that we just don't have the answers to yet. But it isn't, I mean, things have happened to Byron and myself, you know, away from Uri. He is gifted in his field like Byron is gifted in music.
And
it's a gift.
And yet to many, for example, those who have followed the work of Randy,
no.
they believe that yes. Uri Geller has been totally debunked.
He hasn't, well, not at all. You look at the list of scientists now who said, at first I wasn't sure, but now I know, and these are the top scientists in the world. Just look at his website. I mean, one of the most interesting facts is about bending metal and spoons. So children are doing this all over the world. Now, how can children do it if it's not real? Because they don't think it's impossible. They don't have society saying, you can't do that. It's not.
And how important do you think that spoon bending is as it applies to everything else regarding the paranormal?
Well, the paranormal, when I say mind over matter, that's a very big part of the paranormal. it is. And, I mean, the fact that he can, on command, do something like that, that's only one of the things he does, but is is a proof, really, that, you know, the mind is the most powerful thing we have.
We were together in England at Birkbeck College with in the room was Arthur Koestler, Arthur Clarke, John Hasted, the men who discovered the black holes, and Uri bent the metal, but there was a big compass, you know, set into the ground, and simply with his mental power, trying to move the compass, it's an energy that we don't understand. But clearly, I mean, I saw it, we saw it, all those scientists saw it, you know, the compass needle starts swinging around.
I remember Koestler said to me, what is this, these words, I remember his words, what is this world coming to? And anyway, that was one remark, but a lot of them, they were, you know, there was no question in their minds. One of them, who was Clark, said later on, he said, I was hypnotized, probably. About a year later, he said, no, I wasn't. This really happened. No, I wasn't. This really happened. So it's hard for people to accept this. I've had people see Uri and they've tried to straighten out the spoon. They were so annoyed, upset that he could do that.
Interesting.
And Randy's a magician, of course.
Talk about the first time you went to Moscow. In 1960, becoming the first American artist in a cultural exchange. What happened
there? Well, 1960, you know, was the height, really, of the Cold War. Before I arrived, about 3 or 4 months, the U-2, I don't know how many remember that spy plane.
Oh, I remember it very well.
It was an American spy plane, which Eisenhower said, what's a U-2? I never heard of a U-2. And anyway, it was shot down. The pilot was put in prison, and I arrived there 3 months later. Okay. Anyway, I walked out on the stage from my first concert in Moscow. Wow. And there was no applause. What there was shouts of, you too, you too. The propaganda had totally made us into the most evil people in the world. They were spying on things, and et cetera, et cetera. And that was where this mind, quote, over matter really came into use, because I just quietly, it was very hard, but I quietly sat there until this stopped, because it was really unnerving. And I did, and I started to play.
What did you play?
I played a Mozart sonata, then I played some Schumann, then I played the Chopin Funeral March sonata. And at intermission, I mean, they exploded with applause. By the end of the concert, some of them were really, they came to the stage and were really weeping. And I thought, why are they weeping? It's not just music. It's that the enemy was, I was the enemy, but I was a human being. They loved the way I played, and they saw I was not an evil fellow. So it was very important. And, you know, that music, that's what music can do, actually. There are no words to it. People can dream what they want. But it had the effect of really changing their minds.
I wonder what happened to those brilliant young musicians of the 50s who faced real physical and even mental problems. I think of Van Cliburn, who dropped out because of the pressure. Leon Fleischer, who lost the use of one hand, but now is certainly performing with great brilliance. Gary Graffman, he lost the use of his right hand. What do you think happens?
I can't answer that, really, but I think sometimes in striving for more virtuosity, we can injure our hands by trying to do too much with it. A young pianist named Murray Pariah did that, and he hurt his hand totally, and he couldn't play, but now he's playing. So I think it's, they just don't know, but that would be one of my guesses, that they just went too far trying to play octaves, 8 notes, too fast or too whatever.
Practicing long hours?
Perhaps. perhaps practicing on ours, and perhaps too much. I don't know, but I think people do practice too much. They should live life a little more and put that into the music, because you know you can only practice technique. You can't practice feeling.
And you mentioned your work with juvenile diabetes, arthritis. Talk a little about that.
I've always, 25 years ago, it was Nancy Reagan at the White House who announced the fact that I had arthritis for the first time. The Arthritis Foundation wanted to do it at the White House so we would get maximum publicity, I suppose. And I gave many benefit evenings for the Arthritis Foundation. And lately I have been drawn to children and juvenile arthritis, which there are 300,000 children in this country who have juvenile arthritis. And arthritis is 50 million people have arthritis in this country. It's a very serious problem. It doesn't, you usually don't die from it, but your life, there are many ways of dying. Life can change so much that you don't know quite what to do.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. How did you cope with keeping your arthritis secret for so many years?
I did because it was, I think about it now and I think, how did I? But I did because it gave me the secret of that gave me power, you know? I thought, I'm not going to tell anybody because I say to myself, I don't have it, nothing. I don't have arthritis. I just threw it out of my mind and concentrated on the music. And believe me, it was extremely difficult. But that's the way I chose. And after 12 years, I decided to talk about it.
Maria, how did you help him during those years?
Well, when you love someone and you see them suffering terribly and yet determined to go through with what it is they've committed to do, and in the case of music, with what they love, I think you just have to be as much of a support as you can. I learned therapeutic massage. I learned, I traveled with a lot of different equipment, like things as pain relievers. I learned hypnosis to help with pain control. I mean, when I think back now, the times that I'd be backstage and see Byron about to go on, with his hands so painful and so inflamed, he would say, I don't know if I can do this. But he just sort of walked out, and all of a sudden this incredible concert would come out. So
and
it
you
was
can play through pain, like athletes we know are doing it all the time. But you can play through pain. I would feel it, and the moment I got involved with the music, no more pain.
And here is Byron Janis playing the Rachmaninoff Piano Concerto No. 3.
In C sharp minor.
And you are hearing the prelude in C sharp minor and not the concerto No. 3. And you love playing that.
Yes, well, it's favorite, one of the favorite pieces of many people, actually. It's one of his favorite, most famous pieces he wrote, I think.
Thank you. Janice playing the Rachmaninoff Prelude No. 3 and his new book written with his wife Maria Cooper Janice, Chopin and Beyond, My Extraordinary Life in Music and the Paranormal. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Pleasure to have you here. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.